This is a No Surf Music, Burning River Fireside Chat. With guest, Billy Joe Shaver. I'm your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. For the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more, point your browser to nosurfmusic.com. This is another edition of No Surf Music, Burning River Fireside Chats. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammett. And joining me today is a legend of country music, Mr. Billy Joe Shaver. How are you doing today?
I'm all right.
And welcome to Cleveland. It's a bit chillier here than it is back home, I'm guessing.
Yes, it's cold back home, too.
Yeah, well, at least...
We brought some sunshine with us, so...
That's good. It's been pretty nice. Hopefully we'll keep that. Absolutely. Well, we thank you for a lot more than that, because tonight's going to be a great show. We're here up at the Beachland Ballroom, and always look forward to you coming through and singing some of your songs. Mm-hmm. And I know that you've got some new stuff coming up, which I want to talk about.
Sure.
But if you don't mind, before that, I just wanted to talk a little bit about your history for some of our listeners and readers who may not know. You, of course, are one of the original great names in the outlaw country music movement.
You're more like outcast.
Yeah, there you go. Well, that's actually something I want to talk to you about, because, you know, when you you started out predominantly as a songwriter.
Yes.
And, of course, you were singing your own stuff, but like a lot of folks in outlaw country, you know, you had a bit of a hard time getting your own deals and getting some of your own music out there.
Yeah, I couldn't get nothing going. If it hadn't been for Waylon, Chris Christopherson produced my first record.
Mm-hmm.
He heard Christian Soldier, and he put it on the Silver Tongue Devil album.
Mm-hmm.
And then
great album in its own right.
Yeah, and he's, oh God, yeah. Then he started listening to a few of the things I had, and he said, oh, I gotta go and record you. He said it felt like a big hatchet right over his head if it's going to drop, or an axe or something, it was going to drop if it didn't do it. So he actually went and borrowed money, because his father and him, I'm pretty sure it's the way it happened. They kind of disowned him, you know, because he went, instead of, he was a Rhodes Scholar, and he was supposed to go to West Point and teach literature.
Mm-hmm.
And instead he went to Nashville and started working in a bar, bartending and janitor and stuff, and he didn't have no money, and they wouldn't give him none, but he had this album, and he went and borrowed money on it and did my album, which didn't come out for another year, and then by the time it came out, mine had already gone under, so.
Right.
It was the Old Five and Diamonds was the name of it, but I'm not sure if Fred Foster didn't just, actually Fred wouldn't have done it on me, but Chris did, and he got about six songs or maybe less deep into it, and Fred Foster came out, and we were at House of Cash. They had a big studio out there at the
mm-hmm.
time, and he heard it, and he said, no. He bought it from Chris, and Chris made some money on it. And then Fred, of course, he held me back. It would have been crazy for him to put both of us out at the same time.
Right.
And Chris already had his ready to go. And I would have not made it anyway. That was too good an album. And so mine didn't get out. And you can buy it now, though.
Absolutely, and everybody should, because it really is one of the true classics.
That's a good one.
I mean, you know, like you said, produced by Mr. Christopherson, mm-hmm. who's a legend in his own right, of course.
Great.
But just a couple of the songs on it. I mean, Honky Tonk Heroes is just an amazing song. Old Five and Dimers Like Me is, I think, one of your truest songs. And you're a guy who really writes from the heart a lot, so that's saying something. you know, you had, I've been to Georgia on a fast train on that one?
Yes.
It was, okay.
The Honky Tonk Peoples wasn't on it.
Oh, no, that was, yeah, you're right, yeah, you're right. That was Saved for Waylon's album. Yeah. That's right. Excuse me, I don't mean to mix them up. But well, you were working on that at the same time, more or less, right?
I had mine finished before Waylon.
Okay, it just didn't come out until later.
Well, they just canned it.
Gotcha.
It took care of me, you know.
Gotcha.
I wasn't all that great a singer. That was my first album.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris, Silver Tongue Devil was a great album. And, knocked me out. Still does.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went and wandered over to Waylon and got that done.
Right. And that was the Honky Tonk Heroes album, which you wrote all but one of the songs on.
One song on there, Troy Seals and Alabama Bellini, man, they called him. I can't remember his name, but he played piano with Chris. He wrote, so I wish I wrote this song. It was, we had it all.
Oh, right, and, right.
But Waylon had already recorded it before. It was a kind of a halfway hit. And Chet Atkins just really hated me. And he put that on there, made sure they put that on that album so I didn't get the whole album.
Gotcha.
You know? And so, and Waylon had a fit about it, but he still put it on there. And it kind of didn't knock me out of being great or anything. It's just, it just stopped me having a whole album.
Gotcha.
And it was a double edged sword, too, because nobody recorded any of them songs, and they were great songs, all of them. And nobody recorded them because they were afraid Waylon would cover them.
Absolutely.
So it didn't help me that much. I mean, I know it helped me a lot.
It certainly got your name out there to a lot of folks, I'm sure.
Everybody was mad at me, man. Yeah, they got my name right, too, man. They were mad. All the songwriters were mad. They said I just walked up, but I'd been there since 66. So it was all happened about 69, 70.
And so let me ask you about how you got to Nashville, because before that you'd been working a lot of different jobs. I know you started out with you quit school in about eighth grade. Is that right?
Yeah. And went in the Navy.
Okay. Yeah, and you picked cotton for a while.
I had to pick cotton when I was young.
Right.
Chop cotton more.
Okay.
Actually, by the time it was time to pick cotton, it's time to go to school. And I lived with my grandmother, and I had to go to school in Horse County. And all my uncles and them, I worked on their farms during the summer. But they would take their kids and get to come out and take them out of school.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's kids out there, in the M House and all those places, they let them out because they would go pick their cotton. That's why I'm pretty sure the reason why families had whole lot of kids because they're free, you know, free labor.
Gotcha. Well, makes sense, you know, if you...
Yeah, that's it. That's the way it works.
If you're just getting by, you know,
yeah, that's
it helps them out.
That's the way it worked anyway, you know. My mother went to, actually went to Waco and started working in a honky-tonk when I was born.
Right.
So I was singing as soon as I started talking, I started singing and writing things.
Mm-hmm.
And across the railroad track was a settlement of black people, cotton pickers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go over every day. I was 6, 7, I'd crawl across the tracks. My grandma would have to come get me in the middle of the night.
My doors are open if you want to come up
front. One house would have a stand-up piano in front of it, on the front porch.
Gotcha.
And we'd all wind up there, and guys with bottlenecks and stuff would be playing that. I mean, that's where I learned all my bluesy stuff, and that's about where all that came from, actually. Yeah. And I remember them doing Jimmy Rogers a lot, songs, and they all thought he was black. And I did, too. And nobody knew on the radio.
Right.
And he sounded like a black man from Mississippi.
Absolutely.
Like a black man, but he wasn't. And as soon as they found out, they quit singing. But no, they had
still great music.
Plenty of other people, though. I got the drift of the, so many of them. the ones that, that mostly was Muddy Water, McKinley Motor Film, and Little Walter, and Blind Willie McTell. I love his 12 Strings.
It's great stuff.
Yeah, and it all drifted down. And people would take a whack at it. And there's one guy around there who's really good. I don't know what happened to him, but he sure was. He was as good as any of them. And so I learned a lot from him.
Okay. And what kind of music did you get exposed to when you went to the honky tonk then, trailing after your mother?
Yeah,
was that like a different style then, obviously?
Yeah, it was completely different, thing like. But it was Bob Wills mostly.
Okay.
And he also did Ernest Tubb. I liked Ernest Tubb a lot.
Absolutely.
And, as a matter of fact, later on, actually, I was driving a hauling some cattle, and I saw that Ernest Tubb was playing at this. It was after I'd gotten out of the Navy and married, and I had a little kid, Eddie. And he was just a little bitty shiver. He's about a couple of years old, maybe. And I had him in my arms, and I drove up to Geneva Hall because I saw Ernest Tubb was going to play there. And I just walked in the back door with the kid in my arms, and he had his cowboy hat on and all that stuff. We'd put, my wife would put these little elastic things underneath his boots so it wouldn't fall off. And I went in there with him, and Ernest was standing right there by the little bandstand there on the drums. And he said, "Hey, you know, he wanted to hold the boy and all that stuff," and he held him. And then he said, "Does he play anything?" I said, "Yeah, he beats around and stuff." And later, he said, "Well, let him get on them drums." And I said, "No, you don't want to do that." And anyway, he was really nice to us. And of all things, we wound up, Eddie got to be about 13, 14, and he's playing with me. And we got to open shows for him and stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, it was real nice. And we opened shows for Jerry Lee Lewis and Ray Charles. Just about anybody you could think of. It was really hot. We'd open up for him. Jerry Lee, I remember him saying times when he said, "You don't make the killer work tonight." And sure enough, he'd get out there and he'd go to boogie, and I'd tell you what, that guy could do it too. I don't care how good we did, he'd always beat us.
Yeah, it must have been incredible back then.
Oh,
you know.
Lord, it was wonderful, really. It really was.
I can believe it.
It still is. I enjoyed it. It was always a hobby to me to do this. I still love it. I'm doing what I love to do.
Gotcha.
Very lucky. Very lucky. There's a lot of people in front of it.
So let me ask you then. You worked a lot of jobs before you got to do what you want to do, you know. Yeah, you were working in a sawmill then, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, for somebody who was interested in music, that must have been pretty hard because you had to learn how to play the guitar without...
Yeah, I almost had to learn all over again. All I did was clunk, because I couldn't even hold a pick. And I went on, I shot a prayer up to God when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "God, you know, if you'll get me through this, I'll go to doing what I'm supposed to do."
Gotcha.
Because I was only 21, you know, and had a little family, and had one boy. And I did. Wife didn't want me to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I actually had to divorce her to get to go, and I left. And she made sure I didn't have but $10 in my pocket. You know, I was going to L.A.
Right.
And I couldn't get a ride. I was down there in Houston. We were living down there then. And I was on, actually 10 doesn't go up to Memphis, but 10 goes to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm on 10 to go to L.A. And it's getting close to dark. I've been out there half a day, you know. I said, you know, I'll just get on the other side and see what else. And I'll be darned if the first car stop picked me up. He said, "I'm going to take you all the way to Memphis." Because he talked to me and asked me what I was doing. And he said, "There's a fella that did this for me a long time ago, and I'm just passing it on. You just pass it on too."
Wasn't Hank Williams by any chance, was it?
I hope not. Anyway,
it's another great song. But
yeah, he picked me up and took me to Memphis, and it was dark by then. And he said, way dark, and he said, "You don't want to walk across Memphis." He said, And he took me all the way on the other side of the road to the highway over there where I put old man to Nashville. Yeah. And I hitched all the way in. And I got a ride on a cantaloupe truck. I had cantaloupes in the back. And when I got to town, they called me the cantaloupe boy. And I walked around because it smelled like cantaloupe. So I went down to the place where I could take a shower. And found some friends and let me sleep on the couch. And said, it was back during them hippie days.
You know? Mm-hmm.
And I could go play, just me and my guitar, and I'd go play in little tea rooms and stuff. And people was really, really astounded by my lyrics because they were so different.
Right.
You know, they were really out of the cotton fields and stuff.
I can believe that, you know.
Working man stuff.
Yeah, yeah, and there wasn't much of that out there at the time. It was all the rhinestone cowboy in the country. And, yeah, well, that's true too, I guess. But, you know, you're in Cleveland right now, which is well known as a working class town. Absolutely. Well, I think that's, you know, I myself am not necessarily a working class boy, but I think that's one of the reasons why I like a lot of your music, you know. I think Been to Georgia on a Fast Train is one of the great working class songs. You know, you're really talking about how it doesn't matter, you know, what kind of education you are or who you grew up with or where you grew up or anything, but, you know, you're a guy just like anybody else. And actually, I could quote this from memory, but just to make sure I don't mess it up, I wanted to ask you specifically about one of the sets of lyrics from that real quick, which is I got all my country learning, milking and a churning, picking cotton,
raising hell,
and baling hay. And then, of course, the chorus, I've been to Georgia on a fast train, honey, and I wasn't born no yesterday. Got a good Christian raising and an eighth grade education. Ain't no reason for y'all, or
you know,
needing y'all be treating me this way. I know it, I just can't say it. You sung it a million times.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But I think that those are some of your most personal lyrics, which
I
think,
that's
you know.
That's a great song. No one's ever singled it. Yeah, I wondered about that, but you know what? Everybody does it.
I have Miller Lite and Miller Kite.
Petty guy, what's his name?
Tom?
Tom Petty, yeah. And ones that spun off of Grateful Dead.
That's what I thought.
Now I'm forgetting the name too. New Riders of the Purple Sage, is that ever
well,
going
they
for?
Did, they did some too. But just about everybody does George on Fashion. He goes, when you're in a set, like if it's sagging or something, you can throw that in there and just wake everybody up right there.
Absolutely. Well, it's got such a great tempo, up-tempo feel.
Yeah,
and
it's fun.
I mean, those lyrics are just terrific, you know. They really speak to your experience, which is, you know, why I think they're so great.
Thank you. And I do, too. I'm very blessed to be able to do that.
Absolutely. And I was just wondering, you know, for me, personally, I think that, you know, is your top song.
I think so, too. It probably was my staple. It's the beginning where I've been coming from.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So would you say that you think that, you know, that's the favorite that you've ever written? Or?
No, they're like kids, man. You love the Bucktooth ones just as much as you do the others, you know?
So I gotcha.
It's hard to, I wouldn't want to insult anyone.
I understand.
I love them all, really, I do. It sounds like an ego trip, but it's not. I know how much I put into them and how much living you have to do to be able to do these things.
Absolutely. I mean, especially to write the way that you do, which is all experience based.
Any kind
you know,
of writing takes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a lot of experience.
Well, I'm, you know, sort of a writer myself. Not just the music stuff, but I do write, you know, some fiction stuff too. And
not much difference. So.
Absolutely, you got to write about what you know for it to be real. And,
you got to have a heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that, you know, that's why I want to talk a little bit about you and your younger days, too, because I think that really underpins everything that that you've written. But one song that you wrote, or at least that got a lot of play not too long ago, was Live Forever.
Yeah.
And I think for folks my age, who, you know, weren't around when your first albums were coming out or all that. That's kind of the entry point for a lot of people into your music.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing song.
Yeah, my son gave me that melody.
Mm-hmm.
And I carried it around for nearly 6-7 months before I could figure out what to put with it. It's such a beautiful melody.
Absolutely.
When he played it, it was just gorgeous. And I finally figured out what to put with it, and I went to him, and he helped me with the rest of the world. So he and I put together. It was a father and son thing.
Gotcha.
And there's just a lot of love in there. A lot of heart and soul.
Uh-huh. Well, that's one of the things about it is it seems to be...
And belief, too.
Yeah. It seems to be one of your most soulful songs. I mean, you've written a lot of religious songs, Old Chunk of Coal and all those in the past, but this one seems to be more personal in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, everybody keys in on it, and you'd be amazed how many people want me to sing it at a funeral. It's so hard for me now. I've kind of quit doing that because Eddie passed,
Right.
Since I've done it a lot of times since then. But a lot of other people do it. They come and tell me they do it at funerals because that's just to me, that's when you pass, that's the beginning of forever. You're going into another realm. And
gotcha.
You're starting all on your deal. And you don't even remember it. Right, so there ain't no sense in saving all that money and stuff.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm bad about that. I don't waste my money. I have to worry about it. It'll go away.
Yeah, well, it has to one way or another, like you say. But, I think that, not only that, too, but it talks a little bit, one of my favorite parts, about, you're sort of gaining immortality through your art as well.
Yeah.
I wrote down that line too because nobody here will ever find me, but I'll always be around. Just like the songs I leave behind me, I'm gonna live forever now. And I think as somebody who deals a lot with artists and all that, and considers himself to be one himself, I think that's just a great notion that no matter what happens to you after you die, you're always going to be around through the wonderful songs you've written. And
Robert Earl Keen does that as good as anybody. I think a fellow, he usually closes his show. But that's what it means. The word is like Jesus Christ. His word, the living word. I guarantee you these songs are alive. And they'll be around long after we're gone.
Absolutely.
It doesn't matter who did them, or who wrote them, or anything. You're just saying, like Amazing Grace, nobody really knows who wrote that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do.
I got you. So, the other thing about that is, I don't want to make this too personal, but I feel like that song took on a little bit more of another meaning too after your son died. Do you feel like even though it wasn't about him that it's almost because you two co-wrote it and because of the subject it has a lot to do with him?
Yes, it does. I feel a presence of him.
Gotcha. And that was one of the few that you wrote together. I mean, he worked with you a lot playing guitar, and great guitar player, too.
Yeah, he arranged most of these arrangements that we were doing right now. Arrangements that Eddie put together.
Gotcha.
We're still doing them anyway. And we're still working. I know when he was only 13, he went to work with me. And he was just a prodigy or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
He could play anything.
And well, he's got good genes. So.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that because I don't do him a plump. But he worked with me. And just about everything I do now is something he arranged because even when they wouldn't let him go in and record, they'd steal his licks.
Gotcha.
So it just all worked out good for us. And we still, Jeremy Woodall, that plays guitar for me now, he and Eddie were best of friends. And Eddie used to gig him, make him go on. And Jeremy's become a wonderful guitar player. World class, really.
a drummer.
Jason McKenzie is too. Hank Hall is a bassman. He is too. He's played with the Yardbirds and Savoy Blue or something like that. I don't know very much. Bunch of them English people.
Right, right.
He's actually Swedish.
Oh, really?
His name's Hans Adehall. But I said, look, I can't handle that. I said, I'm going to have to rename you. I'm going to name you Hank Hall.
There you go.
G's, and if anybody asks you, tell me you're from Lubbock.
Is that what that accent is? Yeah. Oh, no, I got it.
He's played with me on and off about 10, 15 years.
Okay.
And Jason has too. He's drummer. And Jeremy's played with me about 8.
Pretty good long-standing group there.
Yeah, we go. We all fit together good. We don't make sure. Go down the road in 15 bags of band, pull a little trailer. And pretty much do everything.
I got gotcha. You.
All of us. And nobody was stuck up.
Gotcha.
Kind of like.
You kind of have to put a lot of things aside when you're living on the road, right?
Well,
you know?
It's true, because if you go in those buses, I've tried that.
Mm-hmm.
And I go broke. I didn't stay in long enough. I just went in a bus for about a month, and I figured I can't afford this. And so we all decided that we wanted to make money, too. And so that's the way we go down the road. It's nothing to be ashamed of, because Jesus rode into town on a jackass, so we just come in.
You could live in a van, right?
Yeah, right. We have. Yeah.
I got you. Okay. Well, I feel like I would be remiss if I got the opportunity to sit down and talk to you and didn't mention what has now become sort of a legendary incident a couple of years ago, which is, happened outside of Honky Tonk near Waco.
The shooting,
exactly. And now, you know, everybody, I think, probably knows the story and all that, so I'm not going to get into it. And Dale Watson has kind of made a dime off of it and made the story legendary now.
Well, Dale likes to get me put in a pen because he's about it. He wasn't even hard to a day after it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And Dale calls me up and says, Billy, can I write a song about it? I said, man. He's such a great guy.
Absolutely.
He's a good old boy, too. He's a good friend. And I said, go ahead. He said, well, I already done it. And I said, you got to hear the title. I said, no, I don't hear that. So I'm not going to answer. Yes, you are. What was it? Said, oh, yeah, where you want it? And I said, no, I didn't say that. And he put the song out. The song hit right away.
Uh-huh.
And the prosecution used that against me. They'd say, you said where you want it when you come out. I said, I didn't say that. They swore I did. It took me a long time to get through all that. But Dick DeGarren is a great lawyer out of mm-hmm. Houston. He took my case and didn't charge me.
Well, that was very nice of him.
Yes, it was. He liked me. He liked the music, but he said, you're innocent. He said, they're just trying to stick a feather in your hat.
Right.
And so it happened. The prosecutor got fired. And a bunch of things happened out
there. It was a whole big mess, that's for sure.
It was a frame-up, you know, from the get-go.
But here's my favorite part of that whole story. You know, after it happened, you went to Austin. And I guess, you know, you found out that they had a warrant out for you. And you tried to turn yourself in Austin, right? And they wouldn't take me. You know, if I'm a police officer and somebody walks up to me and says, you know, hi, I'm Billy Joe Shaver. I shot a guy in the face. You know, I would at least make a phone call and say, you know, but they just, what did they tell you?
They didn't want to.
Were they just fans? They didn't want to arrest you?
No, they loved me down there.
I can believe that.
It's really nice, but it would have worked out better if I had got in Austin because I had to go to Waco.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had to pay for the gas then to go to Waco, right?
Yeah, well, by then I snagged a lawyer, Connie Nelson, Willie's ex-wife. She's a real good friend. And she called up a lawyer for me and called with her and all that. And I had hit this lawyer for a little while. But actually, when Dick took over, it's when I was down to business.
Gotcha. Okay, I just find that hilarious, you know. I mean, that must have been a great moment. Like, please arrest me in your face.
Yeah, it was kind of funny.
Well, I think the whole story, you know, obviously going through it at the time, it wasn't too funny.
I
don't
think they'd arrest me for anything. Right?
Yeah.
Waco is that way now. They've changed their whole tune, I mean, of course. I loved Waco because I could go around and nobody knew who I was. You know, as far as they were concerned, I was Bubba Shaver is what they always called me.
Gotcha.
You would say, Bubba, you staying out of jail? I said, yeah.
Try to do at least,
you know,
right?
Try to. But Waco, those people were really, they never lost a case is what happened. And then when Dick DeGaren came down there, they just really scared the hell out of him. And they got to overcorrecting and all that stuff. And the jury didn't take him no time.
Yeah. That's one of the funniest parts to me.
And Willie. And
he had a great set of character witnesses.
And all of them came. Everybody came.
Absolutely. Was Kinky Friedman there? I don't remember if he testified or not.
He didn't.
He didn't? Okay.
I guess he probably didn't know if I was innocent.
Well, you were the spiritual advisor to his gubernatorial campaign. You think that he would believe, you know, that you only speak the truth?
I think he was in Australia, actually.
That could be. So, you know, it's getting a little bit loud here, and I know you got to get ready for the show. But I do want to ask you, because right now you're working on a brand new album. It's your first in quite a while.
Yeah, I've got a song that explains all that that happened down there. I sang it tonight. It's called Wacko from Waco.
Uh-huh.
and Willie sings on it with me. You read.
Okay.
At the very end of it, he does this part. He explains what happened, what really happened. A lot of it they didn't hear. It wasn't even brought up in the trial.
Right.
The old boy had a gun and all kind of stuff. It wasn't brought up in the trial.
Oh, really? I thought he just had a knife. Did he get a gun?
He don't shake a knife anymore. He shot at me twice.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And these are the things you never hear.
We didn't do that because we couldn't find a gun. We had a hard time finding a knife. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't find a gun. And all the people inside there said they heard firecrackers.
Okay.
You know, so that just tells you right there that I only fired once. And he fired several times before I finally.
I got you.
Shot him right between the mother and the father. You know? I didn't mean to. I meant to just try to scare him coming
right
back. But he called it. I don't know how. It was just a lucky shot.
Yeah, well.
Little Benny Darren was there. I was 22. And I never fired one in my life. But I owned
him. Really?
Fired me.
Well, I guess your aim was better than his, even if you haven't shot so much.
Look, I believe God helped me there.
Yeah, well, you were in a bad situation, that's for sure, you know?
Because, you know, I was just thinking I could have hit him in the brain or something, killed him.
Right.
But I didn't. Hit him just in the perfect spot. And he's still got the dang bullet in his mouth.
Right.
He's so proud of it.
I don't know, I would be too. Not that I'm asking you to do anything like that to me, but. I certainly. I'm a pretty nice guy, right?
Yeah, I don't mess with that stuff no more.
But what else can we look forward to? Do you have a title for the new album yet? Or?
No, I haven't quite titled it yet. I think it's. I think we're going to call it Shaver Back with a Vengeance.
Okay.
And it's got a lot of really great songs on it.
I'm sure.
I'm just looking forward to it. We did a live album at Billy Bob's.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be out in February.
Okay.
And I don't know what they're going to call it. It's Billy Joe Shaver.
But it's just all them old songs everybody likes.
Terrific.
Pretty good show.
Okay.
Well, are there any more previews you can give us of any of the new songs that you've already written?
I sang one of them tonight. A few, maybe three.
Okay.
But one of them is called The Get-Go, and it's real political.
Okay.
I don't usually do that, but it felt like I needed to.
So, well, these days, everybody seems to be in that kind of a mood, you know?
Yeah, well, it's just a get-go. That's what I meant, but
Gotcha. Well, we're definitely looking forward to both that, and I didn't even know about the live album coming out. So
it'll be out in February.
Absolutely. Well, I love your live stuff. I think there's some of the more interesting live albums out there.
Billy Bob's, full
absolutely. Great place to play too. I've heard from a lot of people. I've never been down there. I've unfortunately never spent enough time in Texas. Need to spend a little bit more. But
it's a big place.
It is. I mean, I've driven through plenty of times, but you know,
they ride bulls in there. It's pretty big.
Absolutely, I can believe that. But like I said, I mean, we'll definitely be looking forward to it. We'll write you up and let all the fans know what's going on. And it was a real pleasure talking to you again. You know, one of the great honors that we've had at No Surf Music. Mr. Shaver, thank you very much, and we're looking forward to the show. All right, this is Jason D. Diesel Hammond, your host. This
has been a...
No, I didn't. There's a long story behind that one. I am. It's actually a legend in high school that I once took a shot of gasoline on a dare. Now, you can believe that or you can't. Okay, well, there you go. But, a buddy of mine gave me that nickname because of that. So, it's been around ever since. But, this has been another edition of Burning Rivers Fireside Chats.
Yes, sir.
Thank you again, Mr. Shaver.
This has been a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammett, signing off. Remember, No Surf Music is your source for the best in Americana, alt-country, indie rock, and more. For original reviews and interviews, visit nosurfmusic.com.